The Mutual Network and its affiliated stations from coast to coast bring you an exclusive nationwide network broadcast address by General Douglas MacArthur. General MacArthur is shortly to address a joint session of the Massachusetts Legislature. The General has been in Boston since 3 o'clock this afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time, and he has received a hero's welcome. To await the General's arrival in the House chamber, Mutual takes you now to reporter Vin Maloney in the State House. This is Vin Maloney in the House chamber at the State House in Boston. The House is rising to a man. The doors have been opened. Here is the Sergeant of Arms, reporting to the chair.
Admit to committee His Excellency the Governor and General of the Army, Douglas.
Has made known the presence of the Governor, the Council of General MacArthur, and has been ordered by the speech to present it. And here he comes. You have some idea of the esteem and the affection which is felt for General Douglas MacArthur. That was the applause signaling his entrance into the House of Representatives. And now General MacArthur will be introduced by the President of the Senate, Senator Richard I. Furbush, who is now speaking, and we will transfer control to the Speaker's platform.
May Elliott, Chaplain of the Senate, who will offer the invocation. Dr. Elliott.
Let us pray. Sovereign ruler, as we gather to honor a great soldier, we pause for a moment to pray for thy mercy, lest we forget that without the guidance of thy spirit, even the bravest and wisest of men will build their hopes upon the dust. We thank thee that throughout her history, our country has commanded the service of valiant and loyal leaders, both in war and in peace. Skillful and fearless in both military and civilian affairs, swift to defend the right and to overthrow the strongholds of evil, guardians of the heritage of freedom under law, which is the chief glory of the Republic. Never has that tradition been more nobly maintained than in our own time. In thy presence, we dedicate our lives once again to the unfinished tasks that demand the full measure of our devotion. Grant us clear vision and unfaltering obedience to the dictates of conscience, and courage that will match theirs to whom we owe the preservation of our liberties. Amen.
President of the Massachusetts Senate, Chairman of the Joint Convention of this General Court, becomes my pleasure to welcome our distinguished guest on behalf of my colleagues and the people of the Commonwealth whom we represent. it would be presumptuous to recount his long service to mankind. His personal record is history. His character is known and admired by all free men. It is especially fitting for our state to honor him. Here, his father was born. Our sons served under him in two wars. Around him today are Massachusetts shrines of American independence, Bunker Hill, Concord, and Lexington, Faneuil Hall, the cradle of liberty. The devotion to liberty that inspired our patriots so burns in the heart of our guest that he has become one of the world's greatest champions of freedom, whose soul, mind, and tongue no one can ever bind. Massachusetts welcomes his gracious wife, who sits in this chamber, a lady whose intelligence and charm endear her to everyone. Massachusetts is filled with pride and esteem for her husband, the 1951 incarnation of the spirit of 76, I present to you, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur.
In this historic forum, I recall vividly and reverently the memory of those great architects and defenders of liberty who immortalized the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. To this section of the country, men point as the cradle of our freedom. For here was established more than three centuries ago a Declaration of Rights from which ultimately came the constitutional mandate guaranteeing our civil liberties. Here men arose militantly in protest against the tyranny of the oppressive rule of burdensome taxation. Here men engaged in formal combat to sever the distasteful bonds of colonial rule. Here men etched the patriot's pattern, which all races who harbored in their hearts a love for freedom have since sought to emulate. Here men, by their courage, vision, and faith, forged a new concept of modern civilization. Before the descendants of these early American patriots, I am honored indeed to address this legislative assembly in response to its thoughtful and kind invitation. I do so with neither partisan affiliation nor political purpose. But I have been warned by many that an outspoken course, even if it be solely of truth, will bring down upon my head ruthless retaliation, that efforts will be made to destroy public faith in the integrity of my views,
not by force of just argument, but by the application of the false methods of propaganda. I am told, in effect, I must follow blindly the leader, keep silent, or take the bitter consequences. I had thought Abraham Lincoln had pinned down for all time this ugly code when he declared, "To sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards of men." I shall raise my voice as loud and as often as I believe it to be in the interest of the American people. I shall dedicate all of my energies to restoring to American life those immutable principles and ideals which your forebears and mine handed down to us in sacred trust. I shall assist in the regaining of that moral base for both public and private life, which will restore the people's faith in the integrity of public institutions and the private faith of every man in the integrity of his neighbor. I shall set my course to the end that no man need fear to speak the truth. I could not do less, for the opportunities for service my country has given me and the honors it has conferred upon me have imposed an obligation which is not discharged by the termination of public service. Much that I have seen since my return to my native land after an absence of many years has filled me with immeasurable satisfaction and pride. Our material progress has been little short of phenomenal. It has established an eminence in material strength so far in advance of any other nation or combination of nations that talk of imminent threat to our national security through the application of external force is pure nonsense. It is not of any external threat that I concern myself, but rather of insidious forces working from within, which have already so drastically altered the character of our free institutions, those institutions which formerly we hailed as something beyond question or challenge, those institutions we proudly call the American way of life. Foremost of these forces is that directly or even more frequently indirectly allied with the scourge of imperialistic communism. It has infiltrated into positions of public trust and responsibility, into journalism, the press, the radio, and the schools. It seeks, through covert manipulation of the civil power and the media of public information and education, to pervert the truth, impair respect for moral values, suppress human freedom and representative government, and in the end, destroy our faith in our religious teachings. This evil force, with neither spiritual base nor moral standard, rallies the abnormal and subnormal elements among our citizenry and applies internal pressure against all things we hold decent and all things that we hold right. The type of pressure which has caused many Christian nations abroad to fall and their own cherished freedoms to languish in the shackles of complete suppression. As it has happened there, it can happen here. Our need for patriotic fervor and religious devotion was never more impelling. There can be no compromise with atheistic communism, no halfway in the preservation of freedom and religion. It must be all or nothing. We must unite. We must unite in the high purpose that the liberties etched upon the design of our life by our forefathers be unimpaired, and that we maintain the moral courage and spiritual leadership to preserve inviolate that mighty bulwark of all freedom, our Christian faith. It was the adventurous spirit of Americans which, despite risks and hazards, carved a great nation from an almost impenetrable wilderness, which established the pattern for modern industrialization and scientific development, which built our own almost unbelievable material progress and favorably influenced that of all others, which through the scientific advance of means of communication closed the international geographic gap to permit rapid and effective trade and commerce among the peoples of the world, which raised the living standard of the American people beyond that ever before known, and which elevated the laborer, the farmer, and the tradesman to their rightful station of dignity and relative prosperity. This adventurous spirit is now threatened, as it was in the days of the Boston Tea Party, by an unconscionable burden of taxation. This is sapping the initiative and energies of the people and leaves little incentive for the assumption of those risks which are inherent and unescapable in the forging of progress under the system of free enterprise. Worst of all, it is throwing its tentacles around the low-income bracket sector of our society, from whom now is exacted the major share of the cost of government. This renders its paper income largely illusory. The so-called forgotten man of the early 30s now is indeed no longer forgotten, as the government levies upon his income as the main remaining source to defray reckless spendthrift policies. More and more, we work not for ourselves, but for the state. In time, if permitted to continue, this trend cannot fail to be destructive. For no nation may survive in freedom once its people become the servants of the state, a condition to which we are now pointed with dreadful certainty. Labor, as always, will be the first to feel its frightful consequences. It is quite true. It is quite true that some levy upon the people's earnings to pay the cost of government is unavoidable. But the costs of government, even discounting extraordinary military requirements, have risen at an accelerated, alarming, and reckless rate. nothing is heard from those in supreme executive authority concerning the possibility of a reduction or even limitation upon these mounting costs. No suggestion deals with the restoration of some semblance of a healthy balance. No plan is advanced for easing the crushing burden already resting upon the people. To the contrary, all that we hear are the plans by which such costs progressively may be increased. New means are constantly being devised for greater call upon the taxable potential, as though the resources available were inexhaustible. We compound irresponsibility by seeking to share what liquid wealth we have with others. In so doing, we recklessly speak of the billions we would set aside for the purpose as though they were inconsequential. There can be no quarrel with altruism, such as ever been a predominant quality making up the nobility of the American character. We should do all in our power to alleviate the suffering and hardship of other peoples and to support their own maximum effort to preserve their freedom from the assaults of communist imperialism. But when this effort is carried beyond the ability to pay, or to the point that the attendant burden upon our own people becomes insufferable, or places our own way of life and freedom in jeopardy, then it ceases to be altruism and becomes reckless imprudence. I have yet to see evidence that such vast outlays were preceded by the slightest concern for the ultimate effect it will have upon our own liberties and standards of life. This nation's material wealth is built upon the vision and courage, the sweat and toil, hope and faith of our people. There has been no magic involved upon which we might again call to replenish our denuded coffers. We can either advance upon the security of sound principles, or we can plunge on to the precipice of disaster toward which we are now headed in the dangerous illusion that our wealth is inexhaustible and can therefore be limitlessly shared with others. It is argued that we must give boundlessly if we are to be insured allies in an emergency. I reject this reasoning as an unwarranted calumny against well-tested friends of long standing. The survival of the free world is infinitely more dependent upon the maintenance of a strong, vigorous, healthy, and independent America as a leading influence than upon any financial aid which we might provide under our own existing stringencies. The free world's one great hope for survival now rests upon the maintaining and preserving of our own strength. Continue to dissipate it, and that one hope is dead. If the American people would pass on the standard of life and the heritage of opportunity they themselves have enjoyed to their children and their children's children, they should ask their representatives in government, what is the plan for the easing of the tax burden upon us? What is the plan for bringing to a halt this inflationary movement which is progressively and inexorably decreasing the purchasing power of our currency nullifying the protection of our insurance provisions, and reducing those of fixed income to hardship and even despair. I fear these questions, if asked, would be met by stony silence. For just as in Korea, there has been no plan. We have long drifted aimlessly, with the sole safeguard against the ineptitude of our leaders, resting upon American enterprise, American skill, and American courage. But once the incentive for the maximizing of these great attributes is lost, the bulwark to support our failures is gone, and the American way of life as we have known it will be gravely threatened. Indivisible from this trend, and probably contributory to it, is a growing tendency to overlook certain forms of laxity in high quarters. Petty corruption in the public administration is a disease, unfortunately, common to all nations. But I refer to an even more alarming situation. Men of significant stature in national affairs appear to cower before the threat of reprisal if the truth be expressed in criticism of those in higher public authority. For example, I find in existence a new and heretofore unknown and dangerous concept that the members of our armed forces owe primary allegiance and loyalty to those who temporarily exercise the authority of the executive branch of government rather than to the country and its constitution, which they are sworn to defend. No proposition could be more dangerous. None could cast greater doubt upon the integrity of the armed services, or its application would at once convert them from their traditional and constitutional role as the instrument for the defense of the Republic into something partaking of the nature of a Praetorian Guard owing sole allegiance to the political master of the hour. For the purpose of administration and command, the armed services are within the executive branch of the government. They are accountable as well to the Congress, charged with a policy-making responsibility, and to the people, ultimate repository of all national power. Yet, so inordinate has been the application of the executive power that members of the armed services have been subjected to the most arbitrary and ruthless treatment for daring to speak the truth in accordance with conviction and conscience. I hesitate to refer to my own relief from the Far East commands, as I have never questioned the legal authority underlying such action. But the three sole reasons publicly stated by the highest authority clearly demonstrate the arbitrary nature of the decision. The first reason given was that, contrary to existing policy, I warned of the strategic relationship of Formosa to American security and the dangers inherent in this area's falling under communist control. Yet this viewpoint has since been declared by the Secretary of State under oath before congressional committees to have been and to be the invincible and long-standing policy of the United States. The second reason given was that I communicated my readiness to meet the enemy commander at any time to discuss acceptable terms of a ceasefire arrangement. Yet, for this proposal, I was relieved of my command by the same authorities who since have received so enthusiastically the identical proposal when made by the Soviet government. The third and final reason advanced was my replying to a congressman's request for information on a public subject then under open consideration by the Congress. Yet both houses of Congress promptly passed a law confirming my action, which indeed had been entirely in accordance with a long existing and well recognized the one written policy. This law states that no member of the armed forces shall be restricted or prevented from communicating directly or indirectly with any member or members of Congress concerning any subject unless such communication is in violation of law or the security and safety of the United States. And this formal enactment of basic public policy was approved without the slightest dissent by the President. Is there wonder that men who seek an objective understanding of American policy thinking become completely frustrated and bewildered? Is there wonder that Soviet propaganda so completely dominates American foreign policy? And indeed, what is our foreign policy? We hear impassioned appeals that it be bipartisan, violent charges that sinister efforts are being made to obstruct and defeat it. But I defy you or any other man to tell me what it is. It has become a mass of confused misunderstandings and vacillations. It has meant one thing today, another tomorrow. It has almost blown with every wind, changed with every tide. The sorry truth is, we have no policy. Expediences as variable and shifting as the exigencies of the moment seem to be the only guide. Yesterday, we disarmed. Today, we arm. And what of tomorrow? We have been told of the war in Korea that it is the wrong war, with the wrong enemy, at the wrong time, and in the wrong place. Does this mean that they intend, and indeed plan, what they would call a right war, with a right enemy, at a right time, and in a right place? If successful in mounting the North Atlantic Pact in 1953 or 1954, or at one of the ever-changing dates fixed for its consummation, what comes then? Do we mean to throw down a gauge of battle? Do we mean to continue the fantastic fiscal burden indefinitely to our inevitable exhaustion? Is our only plan to spend and spend and spend? Do we intend to resist by force red aggression in Southeast Asia if it develops? Do we intend to take over commitments in the explosive Middle East? Do we intend to enter into a series of military alliances abroad? Do we intend to actually implement by force of arms the so-called Truman Plan? These are questions that disturb us, because there is no answer forthcoming. We do want and need unity and bipartisanship in our foreign policy. But when there is no policy, we can but dangerously drift. In Korea, despite the magnificent performance of our fighting forces, the result... has been indecisive. The high moral purpose which so animated and inspired the world a year ago yielded to the timidity and fear of our leaders as, after defeating our original enemy, a new one entered the field which they dared not fight to a decision. Appeasement thereafter became the policy of war on the battlefield. In the actual fighting with this new enemy, we did not lose, but neither did we win. Yet it can be accepted as a basic principle, proven and reproven since the beginning of time, that a great nation which enters upon war and fails to see it through to victory must accept the full moral consequences of defeat. Now that the fighting has temporarily abated, the outstanding impression which emerges from the scene is the utter uselessness of the enormous sacrifice in life and limb which has resulted. 1 million soldiers on both sides, and unquestionably at least a like number of civilians, are maimed or dead. A nation has been gutted. And we stand today just where we stood before it all started. The threat of aggression upon the weak by those callously inclined among the strong has not diminished. Indeed, nothing has been settled. No issue has been decided. This experience again emphasizes the utter futility of modern war. Its complete failure as an arbiter of international dissensions. Its threat must be abolished if the world is to go on. And if it does not go on, it will go under. We must finally come to realize that war is outmoded as an instrument of political policy. That it provides no solution for international problems, that it but threatens the participants with mutual national suicide. We must understand that in final analysis, the mounting cost of preparation for war is in many ways as materially destructive as war itself. We must find the means to avoid this great sapping of human energy and resource. This requires leadership of the highest order, a spiritual and moral leadership, a leadership which our country alone is capable of providing. While we must be prepared to meet the trial of war if war comes, we should gear our foreign and domestic policies toward the ultimate goal, the abolition of war from the face of the earth. This is what practically all mankind, all the great masses which populate the world, long and pray for. Therein lies the road. the only road to universal peace and prosperity. We must lead the world down that road, however long and tortuous and illusory it may now appear. Such is the role, as I see it, for which this great nation of ours is now cast. In this... In this, we follow the cross. If we meet the challenge, we cannot fail. But no end may be achieved without first making a start. No success without a trial. On this problem of greatest universal concern, unless we address ourselves to the fundamentals, we shall get no farther than the preceding generations which have tried and failed. Convention after convention has been entered into, designed to humanize war and bring it under the control of rules dictated by the highest human ideals. Yet each war becomes increasingly savage as the means for mass killing are further developed. You cannot control war. You can only abolish it. Those who shrug this off as idealistic are the real enemies of peace, the real warmongers. Those who lack the enterprise, vision, and courage to try a new approach when none others have succeeded fail completely the most simple test of leadership. As I have traveled through the country since my return, I find a great transformation in American thought to be taking place. Our apathy is disappearing. American public opinion is beginning to exert its immense power. The American people are expressing themselves with dynamic force on foreign policy. This is exerting a profound influence upon the Soviet course of action. Few events in the life of the Republic have been more of more significant importance nor more heartening than this rallying of the collective will of the American people. They are putting pressure upon their own leaders and upon the leaders of those with whom we are directly or indirectly engaged. And just as it has cast its influence upon policy and events abroad, it can be brought to bear with no less telling effect upon policy and events at home. Therein lies our best hope in the battle to save America. The full weight... The full weight of an aroused, informed, and militant public opinion. I stated in Texas, if it be that my relief was the spark which ignited this great power of American public expression, which caused our people to rise above the level of narrow partisanship, to unite in a common crusade to effect a spiritual rebirth in American life, which restored to the American people the full glory and dignity of self-rule, under those same high principles and ideals which animated our fathers, which restored a lost faith in ourselves and our free institutions, which provided the symbol for rallying the mighty forces for good throughout the land, then I would be thankful indeed to a far-seeing and merciful God and could not ask for more. We stand today at a critical moment of history, at a vital crossroad. In one direction is the path of courageous patriots seeking in humility but the opportunity to serve their country. The other, that of those selfishly seeking to entrench autocratic power. The one group stands for implacable resistance against communism. The other for compromising with communism. The one stands for our traditional system of government and freedom. The other for socialist state and slavery. The one boldly speaks the truth. The other spreads propaganda, fear, and deception. The one denounces excessive taxation, bureaucratic government, and corruption. The other seeks more taxes, more bureaucratic power, and shields corruption. The people, as the ultimate rulers, must choose the course our nation shall follow. On their decision rests the future of our free civilization and the survival of our Christian faith. Not for a moment do I doubt that decision or that it will guide the nation to a new and fuller greatness. Good night.